Good day, everyone. Welcome to Briefs, our Blue Bahamas podcast, where we talk about issues related to the conservation of our Bahamian environment that sustains our way of life. I'm your host, Crystal, today with Heather and Jasmine, all from Brief, and we're discussing Brief celebrating 10 years of Ocean Atlas and the coral reefs, the Sir Nicholas Nuttall Coral Reef Sculpture Garden in the waters near Clifton. And we are also talking about the creation and the evolution of the Coral Reef Sculpture Garden and its impact on the Bahamas. We know that it is a very popular site. If you have seen, I know this is not a television show, but picture this. If you've seen the large 60-ton statue of a girl, you know, with a hand out on the side of her head, you know, kind of, what do they call that position? I don't know. Yeah, kind of bent over, kind of huddled up.
Yeah, so the main aim of that position was to kind of represent her almost holding up the ocean. Mm. So she's holding the weight of the ocean on her shoulders, yeah.
Yeah, and so most people have seen that sculpture in Clifton. Also, Heritage Parks also posted a lot because you could actually book a snorkel tour through Clifton to snorkel at that site. And snorkeling is not diving, so you don't have to worry about being underwater the entire time. But it's really cool. It's really cool to go out there. And Brief actually was responsible for curating that whole space. And international artist Jason DeCare Taylor came over, and he kind of put everything together. And Willis E. Tynes was the Bahamian artist who was a big part of that. Also, the sculptor of the Virtuoso Man. And it was a collaborative effort, you know, between local artists and international curators.
Yeah, and just to give everybody a background on what this site looks like. So at the site, at Clifton Heritage National Park, we have a snorkel booth where persons can put on their snorkel gear. And near there, we have informational signs on what to expect. But the main portion of this site is Ocean Atlas, like Crystal talked about. And Ocean Atlas is the largest underwater sculpture in the world. And so she depicts a young girl representing the younger generation holding up the weight of the oceans, or the weight of conservation for the younger generation. So showing that the fate of our future is in the hands of our younger generation. And then we have Virtuoso Man, who was designed by Willis E. Tynes. And that is a sculpture that depicts the older generation. So it's an older gentleman who's holding a staff and looking in the direction of Ocean Atlas. It's about, I'd say, about 20 feet off from Ocean Atlas. And he represents the older generation passing the torch of conservation on to the younger generation. So we have a bit of symbolism there. So art lovers love to come there. Free divers enjoy free diving from that site as well. We also have 66 reef balls lining that area. And what reef balls are cement structures, marine safe cement structures that enhance coral growth and biodiversity. So they become living reefs where corals can grow, fish can hide out from large predators, especially since that area is a bit sandy. So it just helps with the biodiversity or different kinds of animals and plants in that area. And then lastly, we have our Lucayan face, which was designed by Andre John, who represents the original inhabitants of the Bahamas and pays homage to the original Bahamians. And then lastly, we have our coral trees, or our coral nursery, as we like to call it. And basically what's in our coral nursery are coral trees, and coral trees are basically our version of reef restoration. So does Jasmine want to introduce us what reef restoration is at our sculpture garden?
Okay, so like Heather would have mentioned, our coral trees are coral nurseries where we would suspend coral. We do have elkhorn growing now, and we would let them grow to a specific size, and then we would outplant them onto the reef just to help the reef with restoring itself. because right now the coral reefs are facing issues when it comes to like pollution or climate change and ocean warming, and all of that is causing the corals to bleach at the moment. So just having any type of effort to help the coral restore itself or give them a little bit more resilience, that's the main reason why we have these coral nurseries.
Yeah, and so at that site, we currently have two coral trees. And the way we build our coral trees, or CPUs as we call them, coral propagation units, is just by using PVC pipe and monofilament line or fishing line to suspend fragments of coral in the water column so that they can grow until they're large enough to be outplanted onto the reef. And outplanting is basically just pruning it as if it was a shrub and then carefully carrying it out to a nearby reef, which is Nari Nari, which is the reef that we outplant all of the corals from those trees on to help with reef structure and reef growth out there. In the past, we have grown elkhorn, staghorn coral, but currently we're working on a special species of staghorn coral that will hopefully be more resilient with the warming waters like Jasmine was talking about. So we're really proud of that initiative. We do face challenges, as Jasmine said, with underwater heat waves and losing some of our corals like that. But we really do appreciate having coral trees out there because it does help for that environment to be a diverse environment that attracts artists, free divers, scuba divers, snorkelers, or anybody interested in really exploring what our reefs have to offer.
And also for our educational programs, I think that it's very, very important that we expose students. I know that it is a goal, a UN goal, that sustainability and conservation is a part of international curriculums, right, in education. So there's this big push now to incorporate a conservation into the education system. That's really important. And Jasmine, I want you to kind of explain to us, what is the value in taking students out? We know that BRIEF has taken out thousands of people, including students, to the Coral Reef Sculpture Garden. And it has, a lot of them say, wow, this is an amazing experience. I never knew that anything was out there. I never would have guessed anything was under there. And just tell us what that impact could be on a young person who goes out to the Coral Reef Sculpture Garden. You've snorkeled there before. You've taken people out there. Tell us what it's like from an educational perspective.
Thank you so much for the question, Crystal. Just to reiterate, over 3,000 students attend BRIEF programs every year. So, and a large portion of them, like you would have mentioned, do attend the Coral Reef Sculpture Garden, and that is an amazing site for an outdoor classroom experience. So much lessons and topics can be exposed just in that simple location. And then also what I do love about that is it's an immersive experience. So you're getting a full body, a full immersive experience when you snorkel, when you get to see the sculptures out, and then you can learn stuff in reference to fish ID, the different coral reef, the different marine ecosystems, and like I say, you can physically see how coral reef plays a great deal in biodiversity. And biodiversity is just having different types of plants and different types of animals. And when you actually go and see that there are coral structures growing on Ocean Atlas or Virtuoso Man, you can see the amount of fish and the different organisms that that all have an interconnectivity when it comes to our food webs. And what I do like about it as well is that the Coral Reef Sculpture Garden has also played a role in a conversational starter for citizen science. You can actually track, by having a location by having a single location, you can actually track the changes over time. So in that, we can actually gauge coral bleaching. We do take photos when we go out there. So it's an important way for us to keep data and records, because, and then also it's also an inexpensive way, because the coral reef sculpture garden is accessible, one of the only reefs around that you can access directly from the shore. So it's very accessible. It's an outdoor classroom, and like I say, you can really see a lot of biodiversity and a mm-hmm. lot of, and really talk about the ecosystems.
And on that same note of biodiversity, I looked online and I saw that the coral reef sculpture garden has actually grown from when they first put up the sculpture garden out there. They had, well, before they did it, when they were planning on doing it, in the planning process, they took some people out and they did a survey, a fish ID survey. Heather, you're all familiar with this, so you can explain this to us later. And they found 14 different species mm-hmm. of fish in that area. Since the 10 years later, right, they come back and they did another survey, and they see that there's over 114 different species of marine animal and plant life, you know, out there now. So it shows how the establishment of something, right, and the care and the attention going into something can really assist in the growth. Because the sculptures was, give me a little bit more on this, but the sculptures were put down there so that corals could grow on them.
Yeah, so just like any structure you put in the ocean, it'll eventually accumulate corals that encrust on the surface, or different kind of fire corals, algae, sponges, sea fans, different things like that. And so just having a structure, that's like why we said when we do these coral trees, we're looking for reef structure. So really bringing it from a 2D landscape into a 3D landscape mm-hmm. and creating areas and pockets and crevices where fish can hide in reef balls, or even just having the sculpture that has actually started becoming a living reef. So we have corals growing on Ocean Atlas, on our coral trees, on our reef balls that we have out there. And so each structure that we've put out there has become a part of the ecosystem. So it's giving back in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome. And I know that there are some other conflicts over there, because, and we can't avoid it, right? We have to bring it up. There has been some issues with oil getting into the water because of the location. We know that there's a power plant in that area, and somehow, sometimes, oil gets into the water. There was a snorkel earlier this year, the World Ocean Snorkel, in June, July, where there was oil found in the water and it got all over the people who went swimming. So if there's oil in the sea and you're snorkeling or swimming, everyone, all of our listening audience, when you come out the water, you'll see all these brown spots all over you and your clothes and the people who you're with. And you'll be like, what is that? It's oil.
Yeah, and it's thick like molasses, so it doesn't wash out. And then you don't immediately notice it when you're in the mm-hmm. water. And you don't want to ingest it, especially. Because, you know, when you're snorkeling, your mouth's open, you're getting water in your mouth. And you can imagine those persons who were there snorkeling who might have ingested it or maybe got it in their eye or their mouth. Mm-hmm. And the harmful effects, not now that it could have, but yeah. in the future.
So imagine the fish, right? Imagine the things that cannot leave the water. We can leave the water and we can go back whenever we want. But imagine the organisms like coral that cannot move, that have to stay there and just deal with it. Jasmine, tell us about what that experience was like for you guys this year, swimming out there and encountering the oil.
Well, we went there to celebrate the Coral Reef Sculpture Garden, and the oil spill was unforeseen. So it kind of damper on the day, but however, it's a really good opportunity to bring up issues like these mm-hmm. in reference to pollution and mm-hmm. and what oil has, the impact of oil, and then it also brings up the topic of loss and damage, because at Briefly, a lot of our gear got damaged within the oil spill, and you know, it really has a cost. It has ecological costs on those animals and on those plants and all those algae that cannot be moved out of the water. But then it also has a human cost as well, because as you would have noted before, that's a popular site for persons who's traveling. A lot of that's a very popular eco tourism spot. It's also a popular education, an outdoor classroom. What about the health benefit the health implications that it have snorkeling through an oil spill? So like I said, it was a conversational starter, and it was a way to bring awareness, because a lot of times I don't think Bahamians realize, a lot of Bahamians, you hear about oil spills, but actually diving or snorkeling in one is a completely different story. Mm-hmm. When you have that gunk that doesn't wash out, like mm-hmm. clamping your hair and all over your mm-hmm. gear and all of over your clothes, it's impactful, and it's going to be one of those memories that you won't forget.
Mm. Yeah, and I feel like it's such a surreal experience being caught in one of those, because you always see it on the news or in environmental right. catalogs, but you never expect yourself to be caught in one. Right. And even those people there, their eyes were opened to what was happening in their backyard. They didn't know that things like this happened on a regular basis in that area, especially. And so it starts with the first steps of awareness and really making sure that people are aware that this isn't just the large oil spills that we need to be concerned about. It's the tiny little ones that add up and really do long-standing damage on those nearby reefs and ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. Right. So like you would have said, Heather, it's really hitting home for us when we actually get to see that firsthand or experience it firsthand. That was something that we were not expecting.
And especially smell it firsthand. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, so it has a scent that accompanies it as well. So could you smell it before, just question out of curiosity, can you smell it before you go into the water?
Mm-mm. No.
How did you find out? At what point did you realize that? Because it is a far swim from the, because Ocean Atlas is 18 feet tall, right? So that's a pretty deep, you know, swim.
Yeah.
At what point did you guys realize that the oil was there?
So I can say from my experience, but it started when my mask started becoming non-visible and brown, and it was like somebody had dipped my goggles in oil. Mm. And when I touched it, it felt like an oily surface or countertop that hasn't been cleaned off. Mm. And it doesn't smudge well, so the visibility, I couldn't see anything out of my mask, and that's when I realized, yeah, it's oil.
And Jasmine, you spoke about loss and damage. Mm-hmm. Is this something, well, we know it's oil, but is there a way, because you always hear about after an oil spill, okay, they've all cleaned it up, it's all clean now, now everything's good to go. Is that realistic? Was that realistic for you, and is that realistic for your equipment?
Well, we had to replace our equipment ourselves. There wasn't any type of fund available that I know of, that you can recoup on your investments mm-hmm. when you experience an oil spill. And that's a very good way to think. Like, if there are companies that are heavily polluting the waters, and just to put this in a perspective, Heather noticed it when she was snorkeling. It was when I came up and I could have just seen a large area of just something on top of the water. Mm. And you got to realize that tide has an influence. There's a current going on. So to even gauge the amount of oil that was there is something that you should think about to make a lasting impression on a gear. And I think about how much persons were snorkeling, about 15 persons.
Yeah, 15
persons. for our gears to be completely ruined. So when you think about the amount of damage that is, and how we don't, and like I said, it was unexpected. We didn't know how long that oil was there. We didn't know how long it continued after we leave. But we can just make a guess that it was a lot. So, and like I say, with loss and damage, there isn't any type of way that we can recoup our losses.
And it sounds really gross too, like the oil getting in your hair and on your nails and your clothes. So if you're out there and you're wearing a swimsuit or rash guard, it's all destroyed. And you know, it's really hard to get out. Did you try to like wash it out?
I washed it out a lot. We use industrial strength degreaser on all of our gear. We soaked it. We used hot water. We tried everything in reference to trying to remove oil, and it didn't work. Well, I had to shampoo my hair about a lot. Like, I'd say 10 times. I had to buy a new bottle of shampoo, and afterwards, I still felt the residue.
And then when these things are happening, we have to act quick to make sure that people aren't leaving a snorkel that we hosted covered in oil. So it's making sure that they're washed off. And that is not an easy task when it comes to oil, because you have to, and we had just gifted them with these rash guards. So it was a bit bittersweet, but even washing the rash guards in your washing machine, they're still going to smell like oil until you keep washing them, until you stop using the item.
And your machine will probably smell like oil too.
Yep. And that's why
you have to wash other clothes in there too.
You could imagine, even smooth surfaces, we could not wash the oil off of. Smooth surfaces where if you spilled something, you could probably wipe it up. It was ingrained into the material after the oil spilled on it.
So imagine what it's doing to our environment.
And what I'm also concerned about is the health implications that it can have on persons who, because we know that trace amount of certain chemicals on are unhealthy, but what about persons who attend there on who frequent that area? And then also, it may not have be enough oil where you can see it, but that doesn't take away of some of the chemicals that may still be in the air.
So there may be traces still left in the water.
Of course.
At any given time.
Of course.
Which is very worrisome.
Yes.
But I guess it's just a hope for the best. So, but you have done a lot of other snorkels in that area and you've not encountered the oil issue.
Yeah, so it's not something that happens every day. We don't want people thinking every day you go out to Clifton in that area, you're going to find oil. It's a once in a perfect instance occurrence. So like Jasmine said, the tides, the wind have to be correct for it to even drift in that location, because it could drift right out to sea or it could drift into shore and we wouldn't see it. But drifting in that direction, you'd have to have the right winds. And then it would have to happen on that day, obviously. And it doesn't happen every day. But in past years, it was a bigger problem than it is now. And they were seeing larger amounts of oil washing up, and it was a problem to where they had to set up a petition to tell them to ensure that wherever the oil was coming from, to make sure that it doesn't run off and that it's properly contained if they do have a spill. So they had buoys out there at one point and sponges, and they were doing some data collection out there, but it stopped since it wasn't a problem anymore. But now that it's arisen, we have our data loggers out there that record light intensity. So that would obviously pick up something like an oil spill. You'd have a definite decrease in light coming through to the corals, because obviously it creates that slick on the top of the surface. So that's another thing we're concerned about, sunlight not reaching the algae on the bottom, the corals that need sunlight for their zooxanthellae to photosynthesize. And zooxanthellae is the symbiotic partner of corals that just help them to get their energy. So all of these ecosystem factors are at risk when we think about these oil slicks.
And for, and then speaking about oil spill, I had the pleasure of being able to interview Willacy Tynes, who is the sculptor for the Virtuoso Man sculpture there at Clifton. And he was more or less the brains, right? One of the people who envisioned this entire space, right? He said that one of the reasons why they did the sculpture garden in the first place 10 years ago was because there were a lot of issues out there with contamination, with oil spills, with, you know, the lack of conservation and the recklessness. So he said that although it was heartbreaking for him to see on the news and hear about the oil spill, it was driving home the importance of them actually to, having the sculpture garden there, because it raises awareness about these things.
Right.
And so it reinforces that same importance for people to be very careful and to think about all of the 114 plus species of marine organisms there and our Bahamian oceans. Because we have to remember, too, we use these oceans, but we also depend on these oceans for our livelihoods.
Definitely.
Tourism is the number one industry, so it impacts you whether you like it or not. And then there's a fishing industry that makes millions of dollars every single year. We're talking about crawfish, we're talking about grouper, we're talking about snappers and all the other marine species that we use and we sell. So these are things that hurt our country when we don't pay attention to them. So that was really important. And I think, and I do urge everybody, all of our listening audience, if you have not yet done it, go and check out, the weather's, you know, a little wonky during the Christmas time, you know, but go out and check out the sculpture garden, you know, if there's a good day, on a good day, and take a look at the sculptures and the fish. And there's a lot of fish out there too, a lot of biodiversity. So that's something that you can do. You can book it through Clifton Heritage Park. Also, we want to talk about how locals and tourists experience, I touched on it a little bit, the sculpture garden. What is the pull of the sculpture garden for visitors? What are the main selling points, I guess, of this great space for visitors?
Well, fortunately, Crystal, we've seen a lot of influencers from all around the world come to see the largest underwater sculpture garden. And we've received a lot of traction on social media from persons posting the underwater sculpture garden. So obviously, like I would have mentioned, that is a tourism hotspot.
Yeah, and it attracts people from different walks of life. So you could be, like I said, free diving. It's 18 feet tall, so that's an amazing place to get underwater photos of your free diving skills, persons who are professional free divers. Mm-hmm. It's also a hub of underwater photography. We have a family of spotted eagle rays that frequents that site that make for amazing portraits with Ocean Atlas, or even just with Ocean Atlas herself. She is an imposing structure in that area, so she is amazing when it comes to underwater photography, especially in the really diverse reef that we have out there. We also attract students, like we said, with our educational trips. We attract artists and sculptors who come out to really experience these sculptures firsthand, marine scientists who come to help clean our coral trees or get their reef rescue certifications, or even just the regular tourist who's heard an article about it and really is dying to come and see it firsthand. And so that place really brings together people from every different walk of life. And so that's why it's really important, like you said, to really bring awareness to that environment. And I think they've done exactly that with that spot there.
And as the, I've heard you call it the underwater classroom, right? What exactly do you teach kids out there, like when you take them out?
Yeah, so imagine a module that teaches you from your books, textbooks, you're seeing images, and then imagine a module that takes you out there, gets you immersed in that environment, allows you to look at the fish that you saw in your textbook firsthand and really believe and see the facts that you were learning in your textbooks. And it really just takes your learning to another level and really blows your mind. I don't want to say blows your mind, but when we take kids out there, they are absolutely blown away by seeing the different fish that they saw on the sign before they got in the water, and really having it as a place for learning, because we have the gazebo there, the informational signs, And then we can also teach students about coral reef restoration out there, or even just about coral reefs or reef balls or everything that that ecosystem provides. And so it's really a place where you can really curate and tailor your learning experience to any kind of those modules, whether it be corals or restoration.
And also to add, brief educational programs, particularly our field trips, they are carefully taught out programs with objectives that align with the curriculums in the schools, and because the coral reefs is a part of our curriculums in reference to one of the major underwater ecosystems. And there you can learn about invertebrates. You can learn about food chains and how the interconnectivity of different ecosystems to one another. And then also from a social aspect, the way we depend on the coral reefs, like in social study, our culture, our food. So, and a lot of persons have never had an opportunity to possibly see like a live lobster, a live conch, or a live snapper outside of being on a plate. So this is also an experience to learn about the different species that lives inside the Bahamian ecosystem.
And brief programs are free, right? Teachers can reach out and they can book field trips with brief so that they can give their students these opportunities.
Definitely the teachers can attend at no cost, and chaperones that attend at no cost, and they just have to be responsible for their transportation to get there. But on one more thing, there is a $3 fee for each student to and they'll have to sign waivers to be a part of a field experience.
Okay, awesome. And so as we close out, because we are out of time now, I want Heather, I'm going to throw this back to you, to talk a little bit about the Adopt the Coral. We are in the holidays, and you know, just tell us about the Adopt the Coral program and how people can donate.
Yeah, so if you visit our website at brief.org, we have an Adopt a Coral program. And what that basically is that that allows you to get updates and track your coral's growth. So you would be gifted a coral polyp or a coral fragment or a coral head. There's different categories depending on how much you want to donate towards your coral. And that provides you with a tag with the name of your coral on the tree and yearly updates as well to track your coral's progress and its growth. And so it's a great opportunity, and it's a great Christmas present as well, or birthday present, or any gift, especially for a person who is fond of corals.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Thank you so much, Heather. Yes, and today we were talking about, thank you so much for listening, we're closing out now, but today we spoke about the Sir Nicholas Nuttall Coral Reef Sculpture Garden and Coral Nursery that is, like I said, near Clifton. So you can go and check it out yourself. It is named after Sir Nicholas Nuttall, who is the founder of Brief. And he founded Brief in 1993. So we are out of time, like I said. Meet us again next week to learn more about Brief at Brief242 or Brief and brief.org online. And you can meet us here again, same time, same place at 2 p.m. on Guardian Radio.